From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Did you say you were in your 20s when you got your family home?
Yeah.
And you bought it?
I did. That's very important.
Very important to mention that.
I think I have the mortgage till I'm 97.
Some fall. It's amazing that he's alive.
Yeah.
What happened is this box was discovered on the bottom of Loch Kinnear.
Yeah, how did it get there?
Taken apart. Well, that's the question. That's what we'd love to know.
Coming up on this Still Not Friday edition of Playback Daily, homeowner and author Elaine Feeney has a new novel out, The Canoeing Dog Rescuers of North County Dublin, and the mystery of the thousand-year-old book shrine at the bottom of a lake. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that thinks Baywatch for dogs could be the next big thing. So, let's get started with Oliver Callan, who, in his morning monologue, jumped straight into the inevitable dissolution of the bromance between Roman salute practitioner Elon Musk and the world's leading consumer of orange face paint, Donald Trump.
Well, we all knew it would end up like this. Elon Musk and Donald Trump's bromance is over. Musk was expected to step back from the administration as the, he's the lead shiny chainsaw guy, isn't he, in the Trump administration. But at the end of May, because of the rows about tariffs and so on. They've diverged on tariffs. More on that later. But Elon Musk's kind of, his Tesla brand, of course, is dive bombed. You had those protests everywhere, fires. His unpopularity was so bad that Trump took against him, essentially. But he was meant to keep a foot in the door at this Doge agency to cut federal spending. Then yesterday, he openly criticised the president by bashing what Trump has regarded as his biggest achievement in his second term, the big, beautiful spending bill. It was passed by the House of Representatives last week. Now it's going to the Senate. It is basically a multi-trillion dollar tax break for very wealthy people and a pledge to increase defence spending, which has Musk all het up. He was talking to a CBS presenter here, and this was his mistake, or it might have been an exit plan.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly. Which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along, I mean, like, everything he's done on Doge gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't know if it can be both. My personal opinion.
The presenters always have to chortle along with him. That's how you get the interview. You have to kind of go, you're the funniest man I've ever met. And so within a couple of hours of that interview going out, the White House said, well, Elon Musk is now fully leaving the administration, not even keeping a foot in the door. And they all pretended this was exactly as planned. But he has definitely been bumped a few days early. And it's an incredible fallout. Elon Musk's wealth, it soared after that November election because he had bet so big on Trump's campaign, $250 million of his own money, apparently, and it was seen to have paid off, and there would be huge contracts coming for SpaceX and his other companies. And his wealth at the height of it, $420 billion around Christmas time, which is incredible when you think 20 years ago, 2005, the richest person on earth was Bill Gates with $46 billion. Now the richest person, $420 billion. So he returns now to the wounded Tesla brand. He lost $120 billion since the ructions began in the Trump administration. So his wealth there in April fell below the $300 billion mark for the first time in years. Now, he's still the richest man in the world. He's not going to go hungry, that's for sure, or any of his many, many children. But he'd need to pull off a miracle, Tesla, too. The brand is very badly beaten there. But it'll be difficult to rebuild his own image. As Frankie Boyle, comedian, once joked, Elon Musk is a horrendous human being, even by South African standards. That's a Frankie Boyle line. Very clever joke.
Even by South African standards. Nice. Of course, South Africa won't have to worry about all the white supremacists ranting about how downtrodden they are for much longer, as they'll all be taken into the welcoming bosom of Trump's America. But it's not all burgers and fries for the King of Grift, as last night, a federal court ruled that the president can't just decide to impose tariffs on a whim. Imagine.
The US Court of International Trade said the president has overstepped his authority in imposing reciprocal tariffs globally and indeed unilaterally on Mexico and Canada. The White House, in response, Stephen Miller, his policy guy, said this is another judicial coup, which is part of that MAGA movement to undermine judges, which we should keep an eye on. But the thing that's most annoying him is not the courts shooting everything down. It's a new acronym, first floated by the Financial Times, now making the rounds in Wall Street. And it's a blueprint for playing the stock market among the bros, because it is mostly bros, in 2025. It's the TACO trade, T-A-C-O, which stands for Trump Always Chickens Out. He hates this. So the market kind of dips sharply every time Trump announces trade war stuff and then inevitably rockets back up when he completely retreats. In other words, when Trump announces new tariffs, it's a good time to buy. There are several examples of the trade, of the TACO trade at work. Liberation Day, remember, that was the 2nd of April. The S&P 500 had tanked 12%. Then on the 9th of April, he said, we'll have a 90-day pause. And there was a furious stock rally in the S&P. That's the index for the top 500 performing companies in America. So that's kind of, that's the TACO trade. He always chickens out. And then there's the China one, which he said he'd never bow down on. And he did, and it jumped to 1% since he paused, lowered tariffs for 90 days because Trump always chickens out. So Wall Street and the stocks are the only people he really has any interest in or respect for. So he's pretty irate when a journalist asked him about the TACO trade joke doing the rounds overnight.
6 months ago, this country was stone cold dead. We had a dead country. We had a country people didn't think it was going to survive. And you ask a nasty question like that. It's called negotiation. You set a number. And if you go down, you know, if I set a number at a ridiculous high number and I go down a little bit, you know, a little bit, they want me to hold that number, 145% tariff. Even I said, man, that really got up. You know how it got? Because of fentanyl and many other things, and you added it up. And in many ways, I think we really helped China tremendously because, you know, they were having great difficulty because we were basically going cold turkey with China. We were doing no business because of the tariff, because it was so high. But I knew that. But don't ever say what you said. That's a nasty question. Go ahead. President, to me, that's the nastiest question.
The nastiest question and the gibberish of it. We all know. We know the tariffs thing. It's all fake. And it is a... Who knew a taco would make him mad as hell? I thought he'd love an old taco. But look, the tariffs, they clearly are a distraction. Like the war on universities, the real story is the extraordinary enrichment of himself. The cryptocurrency that's made millions for the family, including 18-year-old Barron and the son of Steve Witkoff, the Middle East envoy. There's great work in the New York Times have a big investigation on this because they go into all the deals. The Amazon deal that they paid stupid money for Melania's book and the use of the library project to receive donations. I mean, he had that major win. He collapsed illegal immigration into America, which is what voters wanted. He could have rested on that as a success and not gone into all the other things that have crashed his ratings, even among Republicans and the jet from Qatar that's been criticised by the most extreme MAGA people.
Is there such a thing as a less extreme MAGA person? While you're thinking about that, let's abruptly pivot to the equine visage and research that shows, well, why the long face?
Horses have a complex repertoire of expressions, according to a new study. They produce a rich and complex repertoire of facial expressions, and we should not overlook the nuances in these if we want to truly understand the subjective experiences of horses, says the head of the research, which is all about including the care and welfare of horses. So horsey people will know some of this already. Research found almost all the facial movements occurred in all of different contexts, but some are more particular to certain types of interaction. So they found basically that when you have a nice, friendly, kind of peaceful interaction with a horse, horse-to-horse friendly interaction, the animals kind of put their nose forward. But in contrast, when paying attention to something and they're kind of curious about it, the horse's ears are typically forward and pulled together. So they go forward and come together. During aggressive encounters, the ears tend to be flattened and backward facing, while the inner brows were raised. Their eyebrows and everything are involved here. And the nostrils dilated and the head lowered. That's when there's an aggressive, angry moment happening. So the ears, yeah, they go back and the inner brows go up. Dilate the nostrils and put the head down. During play, the lower lip is depressed, the chin raised, lips parted, mouth stretched open wide, and the ears are rotated and lying backwards. That's when they're in play. And primates and some carnivores also open their mouths during play. But these face expressions have been anecdotally recognised in horses previously, but this is the first time we have research that shows it definitively and definitely exists.
And that's our excerpt from the Oliver Callan morning monologue, Hitting the Trail on the Horse It Came In On. Here's a stat from Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Just one in every 250 teenage girls cycles to school. That compares to one in every 25 teenage boys. That stark gap is at the heart of a new national campaign called And She Cycles, run by Ontashka's Green Schools programme. Reporter Maura Fay looked into this and told Claire what she found.
It's all about breaking down barriers that stop girls from cycling, whether it's feeling unsafe, worrying about how they look, or just not seeing anyone like them on a bike. But the campaign isn't just about cycling to school. It's about encouraging girls to take it up as a hobby too, and to see it as something that they can enjoy. 11 schools from across the country were recently recognised for their involvement in the campaign, and it was St. Louis Secondary School in Carrickmacross, County Monaghan, that was named Outstanding Ambassador School of the Year. I met with three transition year students from the school who were involved in the campaign. I first spoke to 16-year-old Lucy McGinnity from Dunamoyne, who explained to me what the initiative set out to do.
So the Anti-Cycles is a new programme, and it's to encourage girls to get out cycling more. It's also to make sure we know the proper skills so that we can go out cycling safely, and to make sure we know what to wear, like the high-vises and the helmets, and just make sure we're having fun when we're out cycling.
And do you cycle much in your spare time?
Yeah, so I live out in the country and they are small roads, however, they're quite quiet, so it's quite easy for me to cycle. And yeah, I do cycle for fun quite often.
Why do you think girls your age are a little bit reluctant to cycle?
I think girls my age could be quite self-conscious sometimes. And, you know, it's kind of hard to cycle when you're caring about your appearance because the helmet and the high-vis, you can't really choose what you get to wear sometimes when you're thinking about your safety. Also, that reason, safety, you know, parents might not be as comfortable sending out their daughters cycling on busy roads and stuff.
So are the concerns then, Maura, over the appearance? Is that the main barrier to teenage girls cycling? Is that what you found?
Well, that's something I put to the two other students in the group, Katie Woods and Katie Donoghue. They told me that while appearance is definitely a factor, they do have other concerns, such as poor cycling infrastructure.
I'm Katie Woods, I'm 16 and I'm from Annamullen.
And do you cycle much in your spare time?
No, I cycle a bit in my recreational time at home. I live in the countryside, so the roads are nice and quiet.
And do you cycle just for fun or to go places? Or
I cycle just for fun, as in like Carrick and the surrounding area, there isn't a whole pile of infrastructure for us to cycle. We don't have bike lanes, but we have contacted the county council about it, and we're hoping to get a bike rack for our school to try and push that initiative once again.
And tell me, why do you think, you know, there are more boys your age are more likely to cycle than girls? Like, why is it so few girls are cycling?
I think, as Lucy said, one of the things is just not having control over how you look when you're cycling, but also I think the safety. I don't think boys are as generally concerned about the safety, especially living in rural areas. It can be hard to go out, especially on your own, and cycle. But I know during COVID a lot of girls cycled as groups together, and I'm hoping we can push that initiative again to go as groups to help build the community.
My name is Katie Donoghue, I'm 16 and I'm from Carrick. I cycle as a hobby with my friends. In COVID obviously we cycled a lot, but now I've gotten back into cycling with my friends as a fun activity.
Do you think maybe school uniforms are sometimes the reason why girls are a little bit unreluctant to cycle to school? Because I know here you have the choice of wearing either trousers or skirts.
Definitely, because there's no way I'd be cycling to school in the skirt. I'd have to wear the trousers or the PE gear, but you're not meant to wear the PE gear if you don't have PE. So I think that, yeah, that would affect girls cycling to school, definitely.
Why do you think girls your age are a little bit more reluctant to get out and cycle? It seems to be something that you really enjoy. So why wouldn't you take part in it then?
I think some girls, as the girls have said, like, definitely appearance, because some girls are just like weary of their physical appearance on the bikes. And then if they want to go out, say they don't want to wear a helmet, but they can't, and maybe their parents would be more reluctant to let them out on the roads if they're not safe and everything.
And what's been the best thing that you've learned out of doing this initiative?
I think the best thing I've learned is just like to be safe on the roads, because we have to be safe, and just to have fun when you're cycling, and don't be conscious about anything because everyone's the same.
It's They mentioned safety, and apart from appearance, that appears to be another big concern, doesn't it? Road safety.
It is, Claire, and they tackled that in a number of ways through the campaign. They ran workshops on using safety gear, learning the correct hand signals, even basic bike maintenance. The girls assured me they're now all fully capable of fixing a puncture, which is a lot more than some of us can say.
Good for them.
Yeah. And so also the lack of cycling infrastructure. To work around that, they organised a cycling event along a stretch of nearby Greenway, which runs from Kingsgirt and Cavan to Navan and Meath. So Katie told me how that day went.
So the Greenway Day was an event we ran on the 12th of February. There was a Greenway about 10 kilometres away from us. So we thankfully had a bus company here in Carrick who graciously donated us two buses so that we could get the girls to the Greenway safely and also the bikes. When we got there, we did a 22 kilometre cycle on that Greenway, and it was just great because it was safe, there was no cars, the girls could have fun without worrying about it, and we did make sure everyone was safe and wearing our helmets. That was one of the conditions of being allowed to go.
And how many girls went to the Greenway Day?
We had about 44 girls. We had a mix of first, second and TYs.
Was it a lot of fun?
I think I can speak for everyone when I say it was great crack. We had music going, we had a pit stop about halfway through where we got some nice treats, so I think we all just really enjoyed it.
And do you think that kind of initiative will encourage more girls to take cycling up as a hobby?
I do think so, and we're hoping to maybe make it an annual thing where we maybe start out the school and get people back out again as recreation on greenways, and we might even open it up to the wider community, because I think that really just let a lot of girls remember how much they enjoyed it, because as they get older, I don't hate the cycle as much.
And why is it, do you think, that as they get older, they just get a little bit more reluctant to cycle?
I think one of the reasons is just life gets busy. Like when you turn 16, you get jobs, you're going out with your friends, there's different things to do. And I just don't think people have time for it. And then when they do have time, they forget how much they enjoy it. So I do think this will really help that.
On your bike, love. That's reporter Maura Fay on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne talking about a new national campaign to get more teenage girls cycling. A book shrine that was found at the bottom of a lake in Longford has undergone an epic 39 years of conservation work at the National Museum, and it'll go on display this week. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, conservator Dr. Paul Mullarkey spoke to Ray about the find and what we'll be able to see in the exhibition.
So what is a book shrine first, Paul?
Okay, Ray. Well, a book shrine is really, it's like, if you could imagine, it's a box that would have contained a manuscript that probably would have belonged to a saint or revered ecclesiastic. Now, it's probably most, the ones we were talking about today, the Loch Nail Shrine, it's about the size of a large, well, telephone directory. People remember what telephone directories were like. And the interesting thing about this is once the book went into the shrine, it was completely sealed. So there's no way of accessing this. You couldn't pull over a sliding panel or a hinge. So once it went into this box, it was never meant to come out again. So it was presumably like it would have belonged to a saint. It would have been like a personal prayer book, a mass book with some charms and spells. And it would have been used, probably the monastery had it, and they wanted shrines as well. They're actually used as a source of revenue. So they would have made, encased this in a precious box. So the Loch Nail Shrine, it's made from wood. And then onto this, you have plates of like tin, which brought tin bronze, but you've also gold, and you've lovely interlaced animals as well, amber and bosses. So it's very, very decorative. It's actually like a manuscript page in three dimensions. So that's one of the reasons we have it actually in the exhibition as well anyway.
Is it in a box, Paul? Is there a box?
It is a box, but what happened is this box was discovered on the bottom of Loch Nail.
Yeah, how did it get there?
And the box had been taken apart. Well, that's the question. That's what we'd love to know. Because
right.
We can imagine now, this, there may well have been... See, the Vikings were notorious for their raids and for taking shrines and crosses and whatever else. And this could have been the result of a Viking raid. Now, also, we have to bear in mind, there's also lots of little if you want, feuds between churches as well. Like, you have a better relic than mine, or you have a better shrine than mine. So that's another option to take in mind. But the Vikings always get a bad press. Oh, yeah, they burned the manuscripts and they threw them away. No, they didn't always. So if there was a manuscript in this, they probably would have known that this is going to be of great value to the local community. So what they probably would have done is actually ransomed it back. And we do have Irish manuscripts on the continent, and they have, like, inscriptions. inscriptions on them saying this is ransom back for six horses or 20 ounces of gold.
I see, very good.
And so I'd say if it was Viking, well, so the problem is we don't have the manuscript that was originally in the box. So
oh, you don't, you only have the box.
Only have the box, but the box is taken apart and probably wrapped in something and either lost or deposited overboard. But what had happened and why we're so lucky to have this today is that this is one of these midland lakes. It's like a bog. So when it settled into the actual bottom of the lake, it formed a sea layer.
Yes.
So the normal, if you want, decay process, it didn't happen. So it actually survived in really, really good condition.
How old are we talking?
We're talking probably early 9th century, so 1,200 years, which is a fair whack.
Spectacular, yeah.
Yeah.
So would it be, if we can't keep it, you're not going to have it? It could have been that, couldn't it? That
it could have been that as well, yeah. And the other option as well, with the Vikings, what they would have done, and we have examples in the museum and elsewhere, they would have taken apart our shrines, crosses, and what they would have done is taken off some of the really elaborate decorative
crafts, I see, yes.
Torn them into brooches and brought them back as souvenirs. So a lot of them actually turn up in Viking graves in Norway with Irish material or even Anglo-Saxon. So it could have been like a decommissioning thing where we're going to take the manuscript, but we're also going to bring back parts of this as a souvenir.
The lake that it was found in, would you be going anywhere, you know, if you're on that lake? No.
No, it's quite a small lake, but it's interesting in a way. Again, it's a border lake, so it's on, as far as I can remember, Westmeath, Cavan and Longford. So these borders would have had some significance as well. And it was found close enough to a Crown Oak. So these are one of these waterlogged lake dwellings. And these could have been, if you want, used as mini treasuries because it would have been easy to protect. So this may have been actually taken from a Crown Oak and lost overboard in the court.
Now we'll get to the conservation work, which took nearly four decades. But what about the thing itself? How long would it have taken, do you reckon, to make it? What sort of craftsmanship was involved?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ray, because actually once we have it conserved, we can start looking at it in detail. And what we do find is some of the portions of it are really exquisite and it's really high-quality metalwork. They use gold and they use tin and amber. But then we find other parts of the shrine which you don't actually get, that you wouldn't see because they're more hidden. And there you can see little mistakes, so there's unfinished areas. So this shows that there's probably a number of craftsmen involved. It's probably difficult to say exactly how long it takes, but it's probably like, no, I don't mean monasteries are churning out like an IKEA, but what they would have had is they would have made these bosses and plaques, said this one can go in a shrine, this one can go on a processional cross.
Right.
We can use this elsewhere. But look, the best guess is if you had a craftsman with a couple of apprentices, they probably would have made this in, I'd say, 2-3-4 months, maybe, rather than years.
Right, and 39 years to conserve it. Why so long?
Why so long, Ray? Well, that 39 years, it's not a continuous 39 years. When it actually came in first, I remember this now, it was actually on display in the... we had a large tank in Galler Street, a display case, but it was actually a tank of water because it was found waterlogged, and that was one of the problems of the conservation process because if you let that lot dry out, it'll just crack, split, warp. So while we had to find a way of conserving it, we had it on display to the public in this large like swimming pool. But again, a little bit like the Millennium Clock, it did eventually start to silt up after, 6 months. But that gave us time to consider what treatment options we could carry out to it anyway. But look,
and
again,
what do you do?
Look,
what do you do, though? Do you inject it with water or what do you do?
No, what you do, for this one we did it, it's a process known as solvent dehydration. So it was in water, then the water was replaced with ethanol, and then the ethanol was replaced with this other chemical called diethyl ether. Now, the problem with this was we had our conservation lamps actually right beside it all in the museum in Kildare Street. We now have a new, they're 20 years old, conservation labs in Collins Barracks. But at the time, diethyl ether, it's toxic, explosive, and flammable.
Right.
So... doing this what we actually did, we moved out to the state lab and they were very helpful with this at the time anyway, so we're able to use their facilities for actually going through that process to dewater the wood, and after the wood it's then like balsa wood, it's quite light, but you can then inject it with a consolidant like a liquid resin, so once the wood is conserved you can then move on to the metal, and the metal is really it's really cleaning under a microscope delicately with scalpels, needles, even bamboo splints, cocktail sticks, and what we found as well are porcupine quills, which is another As a tool, yes. They actually shed them naturally, so when they're very, very sharp, they're like thorns, but you can actually sharpen them, and they're quite flexible, so they won't scratch the metal.
Amazing inventiveness by our ancestors 1,000 years ago. That's conservator Dr. Paul Mullarkey talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the book shrine found at the bottom of a Longford lake that will be part of a new exhibition called Words on the Wave, Ireland and St. Gallen in Early Medieval Europe. It runs at the National Museum in Kildare Street in Dublin, starting tomorrow until the end of October. Back on this morning's Oliver Callan. And Lucia O'Farrell, the mother of Shane O'Farrell, who was killed in a 2011 hit and run, told Oliver how the public apology from the government this week was a day of vindication after the family's long years of campaigning.
They have apologised, which is a significant step. It's an acknowledgement of the institutional failure which exposed Shane to danger. And, Mr O'Callaghan gave that apology. Tánaiste and the Taoiseach spoke prior to that. And they reiterated what he had said, and the minister said the justice system that operated at the time exposed Shane to a threat that he should not have been exposed to, and the failings in our justice system that exposed Shane to danger on that fateful day. I'm just quoting from his statement here in front of me.
Yeah.
And he apologised to Shane, and I think that was very important for our family, that it wasn't just an apology to us, it was an apology to Shane and of our family for the fact that the criminal justice system did not operate, did not protect Shane as it should have. And I do so apologise. So that's, very significant and profound, really.
It took a very long time and some long, lonely days where you probably thought it may not happen. Or did you always believe that it would occur, that you'd get this public apology because you fought and fought and fought?
Well, we knew early on things weren't just right, but we couldn't get any information. And so very bit by bit, it was a huge, long struggle. We might find, it was like a piece of a jigsaw. You might find the last piece first and then a piece from the middle, and things didn't add up. And it was relentless, because we'd get a bit and it would give us maybe encouragement to find another piece. And we started to piece things together, and then people were very kind and they approached us, said, telling us bits and pieces and phoning us up and said, I knew the man who killed your son. He was in the paper all the time, both sides of the border. And we went then to the various libraries and looked up the Northern Standard, our local newspaper here, the Anglo Celt, the Dundalk Democrat, to get a kind of a chronology of his crime prior to the 2nd of August. And we could see this litany of crime. And he seemed to be getting bail, breaching bail, getting bail.
And we're just listening to you here, Lucia, and you sound kind of like you've become a lawyer in the meantime. You sound like you're the head of an advocacy group, do you know? And this is what it's kind of done to your family, hasn't it?
I'm actually a retired nurse, and I think I have less in common now with my former colleagues than I do with other victims' families, who would ring up each other and rely on each other to say, what should I do now and where should I go? And actually, one of Shane's lecturers in UCD, which has been lovely and kind, and she has said, you've a law degree and master's in law at this stage. I had to research, Oliver. I had to research what should have happened, because in nursing, if a valve in a heart doesn't work, then you know what happens following that. So I had to apply that same thing, what should have happened and then what didn't happen.
Right.
So we went through that for the 14 years, looking, almost 14 years now on the 2nd of August, looking for answers. And we had to get them ourselves, which is very difficult if you're trying to grieve your healthy child who was killed by someone who shouldn't have been at liberty.
Yeah.
And so, they've now put their hands up and said, sorry, this shouldn't have happened and the system failed Shane and he was put in danger. But they haven't answered why.
I met your one of your daughters last year, Gemma, and she was telling me about Shane. He was only 23 years of age, people will know by now. He was out training for a triathlon at the time, wasn't he?
That's right. And he had just finished college, Trinity, and he went out. He'd been training all year and he was, very good swimmer. He was a good athlete. He loved rugby. He was passionate about rugby. And part of the triathlon, as people would know, was a cycle. So this was the last cycle before the event that would take place in Clare. Mm. So he went out and his sister said, would you like... his sister said, they'll have a cup of tea. And he said, I'll have one when I come back. and he never came home. And, you know, his whole life was ahead of him, or should have been. All the study done, you know, his law degree and master's of law in the bag. He loved the guitar and the piano. He just loved people. He loved life. He loved making tea and toast. He loved the chats with people. You know, when he was over in London visiting his girlfriend, he would go down, you know, the markets and bar market in Camden, and, you know, ostrich, whatever was being sold, he would have a chat with the people that were running the market, maybe the African man that had 10 children. And he would enjoy that. He just loved people, and he was very good with people. He drew people to him, and he was interested in their lives, and he was fascinated with, you know, language and English and life. He loved life. He was just a beam of life.
He was a man of the world, but he was particularly proud of Monaghan, wasn't he? And talked about Monaghan when he's in Dublin a lot.
He came home. Everyone in UCD and Trinity knew about Carrick and Cross because he spoke about it so often. And every weekend he came home, because some of his friends that didn't go to UCD, they might have went to the DKIT in Dundalk, he would meet up with them and they'd play pool and they'd have the crack, etc. And then they'd all get their T-shirts washed and go back to college on the bus, on the Collins' bus back up to Dublin. Mm. So he adored Carrick and Cross. And we live here just on the outskirts, and there's a big estate, an old English estate, Shirley's estate. And yeah, he would sit on the bench and play his guitar and watch the birds coming and going into the woods and see the leaves changing and the seasons. And he just loved nature. You know, he was such a joy. When he would come home at the weekend and the girls would come home, and we have a table that has seven sides on it, and of course there's one spot now missing, Shane's missing from that spot, but they would be chatting about the weekend, about boys and girls and whatnot in college, the usual crack children, teenagers have when they come home from college. Yeah. And I would be kind of thrown an ear in, and then they'd realise I was listening, and they'd all start talking French. And I thought, oh, I can't know now what they're saying. You know, he was a breath of fresh air, and he's just... So it would have been a huge betrayal, Oliver, I felt, not to find out why this happened and why this man was at liberty. Yeah. You know, it was, you know, we needed to do that. I felt that needed to happen.
The remarkable Lucia O'Farrell talking to Oliver Callan this morning in the wake of the government apology for the failings that led to the death in a hit and run of her son Shane in 2011. There's a new six-part podcast series from RTE's Dock on One team dropping this week. It'll also be on Radio 1 of a Friday evening. The series is called Stolen Sister, and it tells the story of Elizabeth Plunkett, one of the victims of Ireland's first known serial killers. The producer of the documentary is Nicolene Greer, and Nicolene joined Claire Byrne in studio this morning to talk about it.
Will you tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Plunkett?
Yeah, so Elizabeth was a 23-year-old young woman in 1976. She was from Ringsend. She lived in Ringsend with her family at that time. It was a big family of eight children. There were four boys and four girls, and they were all living in this tiny little cottage in Ringsend, a two-bedroom cottage. So it was a really busy household. And Elizabeth was a really outgoing person. She had lots of friends. She was very sporty, very outdoorsy. And rowing was a huge sport in Ringsend then. She was a member of the Rangers, and she used to love hiking and camping and going away with friends. She loved music. She loved those 70s artists like James Taylor and Carole King. And she loved fashion. So all that 70s clogs and denim and all of that kind of stuff. So in the podcast, we hear from Elizabeth's sisters, and I might let them say a little bit about Elizabeth.
Do.
Elizabeth was the woman around the house. She was the boss. Four brothers. She would take over Saturday morning when she did day off and clean the house from top to bottom.
If she got her mind set on something, she was going to do it. Headstrong, you'd call it. And with having brothers, she would stand up to them, because my father would say, oh, it's only the girls now wash the dishes. And she'd say, there's no reason why the brothers can't wash dishes too. So that's the type of person she was.
You know that energy that age group has? Everybody's old-fashioned. If she'd argue with my dad, she'd say, that's my prerogative. And we'd be all going, prerogative? What's that? What's a prerogative, you know? So she read Cosmo and she had notions, you know?
In Eddie's house in Cork, he picks up a picture in a frame.
And we have a lovely photograph of Elizabeth. She was full of it, very confident, very athletic. So that
She was beautiful, wasn't she?
She was great, yeah.
For everyone in the Plunkett family, their lives have a before and an after. Life before Elizabeth was murdered.
My mother would dance around the kitchen and sing. She thought she should have been a film star. We were a very united, large Dublin working class family. The bond then was unique.
So that's Eddie there talking about his sister Elizabeth, and we heard from Bernie and Kathleen as well, and we also heard the voice of Roz Purcell, because Roz from 2FM narrates the series. And you know the sense, I listened to the first episode last night, Nicolene, just such a warm, he describes the bond as unique. It's a gorgeous story of family life in Dublin and Ringsend in the 70s as well, isn't it?
They were a really warm, I mean they still are a really warm family, but everything changed for them, that their parents were destroyed, obviously, after Elizabeth was killed. And it was never the same again. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us a little bit then about what happened in 1976 to Elizabeth.
OK, so that summer, 1976, it was a glorious summer in Ireland. It was one of those really warm Irish summers. And Elizabeth had recently fallen in love. She had a new boyfriend called Damien, and they'd been together for a few months, and she'd met him through her good friend Mella, who she knew from work. And they loved travel. They had recently been on a dream holiday to Saint-Tropez. And at the end of the summer, the last weekend of August, Elizabeth, Mella, Damien and another group of friends, they decided to go down to British Bay for a night. Somebody had a caravan and they were going to go down overnight and spend the last weekend of the summer down there. So they all headed down in a couple of cars and they all met up in a pub called McDaniel's Pub in British Bay. They're all having a good time, chatting away. And then a very minor argument broke out between Elizabeth's boyfriend, Damien, and another friend, Joe. They were arguing, they're both into cars, and Damien had sold a car. And
just really a silly little argument. Explained well in the book, but yeah. It's enough to say it was a silly little thing.
So Elizabeth came over and said, "Stop arguing. You're ruining the night for everyone. Just stop it, or I'm going to go home." And Damien said, "You know, let me deal with this, you know."
Yeah.
And so Elizabeth said, and they kept on sort of having this little argument. And so Elizabeth said, "Right, I'm out of here." And she walked out of the pub. Now, you know, her sisters think she wasn't going to head back to Dublin. She was probably just going out to cool off.
Yeah.
So she walked down the road in British Bay. And there would have been actually quite a few people around because it was a busy weekend and, you know, lots going on in British Bay at that time. But unfortunately, out on the road, there were two men, Geoffrey Evans and John Shaw, were in a car and they were on the lookout for a woman to pick up.
Hunting, as it's called in the podcast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Tell us a bit about these two then.
So Geoffrey Evans and John Shaw were two Englishmen. They were sort of late 20s, early 30s. And they had spent much of their lives in prison in the UK for offences like assault and burglary. And they'd met each other in prison. They were labour and coal miner when they were working. And in 1975, they were actually wanted on three charges of rape in England. And one of those was a 15-year-old girl. So they came to Ireland essentially on the run. And they came over on the boat under false names. And when they got here, they committed a number of burglaries around Ireland. And they spent the guts of a year in prison here in Limerick and in Mountjoy. And so when they were released from prison in August 1976, they were actually arrested immediately on foot of the extradition warrant on those rape charges. But they managed to, because they'd been here under false names, they managed to confuse the court enough that there was a case of mistaken identity, that they were actually released on bail. And the families, both the Plunketts and the Duffy families, you know, do question why these men who were clearly dangerous were actually allowed out on bail at that time. But they were nonetheless, and while authorities would try to straighten out their identities. So they probably knew they were on borrowed time. And it just seems that they essentially went on a rampage around Ireland. And, you know, when they were caught finally after they murdered Mary, which was over in Castlebar, so Elizabeth was in British Bay, then they made their way over to Galway and to Castlebar, where they found Mary Duffy. And they were caught after that in Galway by Gardaí. And they did say to guards that they would have continued what they were doing. Mm. They had an intention to kill one woman a week, is what they said.
Right, that was their awful plan.
Yeah.
You explain as well in the first episode how the story came to you at Doc on One, and that's worth retelling.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually surprised that I hadn't heard this story before, because it's really horrific what they did. But the podcast began, I suppose, for us last year, when Elizabeth's two sisters, Bernie and Kathleen, came to the Doc on One and asked us, would we be interested in hearing their story? And they thought really long and hard about whether or not they would come to us and go public, because for almost 50 years, the family has never actually spoken publicly about this. They just said, we'll let it lie. But they just felt now that they had to speak out on behalf of Elizabeth, out of duty for her. And they were very nervous coming to us. But the reason that they came to us was because in 2023, the Plunkett family was approached by the parole board. So as you mentioned, Geoffrey Evans died in prison in 2012, and Shaw is in prison as the longest serving prisoner in Ireland. But he had applied for parole. And as part of the parole process now, families are invited to make a submission to give, you know, whether they think somebody should be released or not. And so Bernie and Kathleen decided to do that as a family. It was a really difficult thing for them to do. They'd both been teenagers when this happened, and so many emotions had been buried, and they were bringing all of that up again. And it was a really difficult and emotional process for them to go through to do that. But again, they felt this was something
they had to do. It.
And then a few weeks after that, they actually were contacted again through their solicitor to say, we're really sorry, there's been an error, and John Shaw was never actually convicted for murdering Elizabeth Plunkett.
So his conviction was in relation to the other case?
Yes.
Nicolene Greer, producer of a new documentary podcast series, Stolen Sister, talking to Claire Byrne this morning. The first episode of the podcast will wing its way to wherever you get your podcasts tomorrow, today or yesterday, depending on when you're hearing this. Friday, in other words. It's also being broadcast on RT Radio 1 at 6:30 every Friday evening. Sounds like another Doc on One triumph. Regular listeners, my sympathies to you all, will recall that on Tuesday's Liveline, Joe Duffy spoke to a woman called Anne Lynch about her dog Rally, who fell off a cliff in Howth. And Anne wanted to make sure that the men who helped rescue her beloved Pomeranian got a shout out. And that's exactly what happened on Liveline this afternoon.
Rally, the dog that jumped off the cliff in Howth. How was he?
He's doing well, Joe. Okay. Thank you. He's okay. Really recovering nicely.
And we were looking for the rescuers, Anne. Jeff Doherty. Jeff, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Say hello to Anne Lynch.
Hi, Anne. Nice to talk to you again.
And Tommy Daly. And Tommy Daly is there as well. Tommy, how are you?
How are you, Joe? How are you, Anne?
You know you saved a dog's life, Tommy.
Well, that was Jeff did that. It wasn't me. No.
Okay,
Joe.
Jeff. Okay, Jeff. Tell us what happened on that fateful Sunday.
Myself, Tommy, and Damien and Sarah, we were out on a paddle with a group. We were a group, the Common Kayakers. So we get together and paddle, and we were out for a paddle, and we could see some people hailing us from the shoreline.
Okay.
Thought they were saying hello at first, but we could see they were hailing us in, and we realised there was something amiss. As we got closer, Anne and her friends were shouting to us, could we see a dog that had fallen? Couldn't until we got quite close. And at that point, I could see a dog not moving in between some of the rock pools.
Okay.
I jumped out of the kayak, Tommy held my kayak, and I went in and I could see Rally was lying motionless, but conscious, a bit of blood around his face, and he looked like he'd had quite a fall. I think it would have been about 60 feet he'd fell from. So able to lift him up and tell Anne and her friends that he was alive. He would need to get a vet, so we gave them the heads up to get a vet. And that we would try and meet them down the coast, because there was no way of getting them back up the cliff.
Of course.
Meet them down the coast at the dinghy club, at which point then I handed the dog over to Tommy to put on his lap. And we paddled with haste down the coastline to meet Anne and her friends.
And Jeff, the blood, I didn't know there was blood. Do you reckon that Rally hit rocks on the way down?
Almost definitely, yeah. And it's, wow. I'd say it was a hard landing for him. I was delighted to hear yesterday or the day before that he had survived. Really was good news because he looked like he had...
He was in a bad way.
He was totally in shock. No movement, really.
Because he's only a small dog, isn't he, Anne? He's a Pomeranian. What weight would Rally be?
He weighs about 10, 11 pounds. 10 or 11 pounds, maybe 5 kg.
5 kilos? Wow. He really is lucky. Tommy, what's your memory of this incredible rescue, Tommy? Well done. Have you done it before? By the way, Tommy?
Well, one of the lads have, yeah. Damien, we've rescued a few horse and a pike and a few bits and pieces.
A horse?
As you come along them on the river, you know, that's on the Liffey.
Okay.
Jeff just did all the hard work. I didn't know whether a dog in shock could take the hand off you, you know. So he placed him into my kayak. So I just slipped off the spray deck. And the dog was very placid, very quiet, mm-hmm. and he started to sort of come around. And I just engaged him in conversation to keep him conscious. And we got him back, and that was it. But Jeff says, we didn't know. I was delighted to hear
that he was alive.
He survived, because we didn't know what the outcome was at all.
But he fell off a block of flats, didn't he?
Absolutely.
The height.
I'm from the top balcony of a block of flats, Joe, and I'd say he fell off higher than the top balcony of a block of flats. Some fall. It's amazing that he's alive.
Yeah. Well done, and fair play. Who rescued the horse?
I think it was the fire brigade in the end. He just couldn't get out of the Liffey. Ah. But I got a picture of him the next day. Yeah, it was late at night, actually. We were on an evening paddle, and it got dark. But the horse, but he had a bit of he'd a bit of form. He'd been stuck in the river a few times.
He probably didn't want to go to France.
exactly.
And what lads or whatever groups, lassies, whatever, coming along the Liffey in kayaks, and they saw a horse that could not be seen from the road. Is that it? And you reported it.
In behind the Italian ambassador's residence, in behind Lucan Village.
There's land
the other side of the river, which nobody can see, only the kayakers or somebody on the river. So when we were finished, we couldn't get him out of the river. So when we finished our paddle, we went back around to, there's a couple of houses on that land, so we alerted the person living in the house, and they got in touch with the horse owner.
I know Roddy is what age is he now, on 4 or 5, but I think he should change his name to Lucky.
I don't disagree. No. I think that is a small miracle. There were many miracles today.
Well done, Tommy. Bye. Tommy and Jeff. By the way, I presume at some stage, I hope not. Have you helped swimmers, Jeff or Tommy?
Yeah, we were out one day paddling back around the hotel towards diving boards, just near the beginning of the walk, and one of the kayakers, Cormac, we could see this swimmer hadn't made much progress.
Wow.
She was in a bit of the tide was racing.
Yeah.
So as he approached her to see if she was all right, she latched onto the kayak. And,
oh, wow.
You know, was quite grateful. We just brought her back into the shore. But she was capable swimmer, but she just got herself caught
Can happen so easily.
Jeff Doherty and Tommy Daly of the Cormorant Canoeing Club, rescuers extraordinaire, and Anne Lynch, relieved owner of Doggo Rally, talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the acclaimed author Elaine Feeney has a new novel out, and she dropped into studio to talk to Oliver Callan about it this morning. The new book is called Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way, a title Oliver is very enamoured by.
Let me go mad in my own way. It almost sounds like an expression, an Irish thing we'd say, but no, it's from the classics,
it
I
is,
gather.
It's actually, yeah, it's very old. It's from Electra, so we can blame Sophocles, and it's a translation by Anne Carson. But it really, yeah, it's a kind of, there's an Irish kind of shtick to it a little bit, I think.
The Greeks
yeah.
knew us
they did.
So well.
Yeah, well, the Greeks knew tragedy yeah. and madness. And the great
Sophocles,
chorus.
He's the great tragedy writer. So like, you're straight into that one. Yeah, I'll find something. And is it, let me know, let you know this or something? Is
yeah.
that the full phrase?
Yeah.
Let me go it's, mad. Yeah. I can tell you this.
Yeah. Well, there's many, many different translations, but
of
absolutely.
Course,
yeah.
That's the one you stick to.
Yeah.
Tell us about the road that you grew up in, because I think that's the inspiration, isn't it? As it often is for you.
It is. It is. I've been sort of, you know, in the same space for quite some time now with these novels. I may never move out of them. But so I bought the bungalow that I grew up in my 20s yeah. and for better or worse, decided to stay there and see if I could write the West in a way. I don't know if I thought about it in that sort of lofty sense at that time. I think maybe I just was, you know, interested in moving back home. And there have been many generations, and I say many because I don't actually know how many, and I don't want to know. Interestingly, that's yeah. So my grandparents had lived on that road, my parents, cousins and so on. So yeah.
There's farms. This is East Galway.
This is East Galway,
where
yeah.
where there's turf cutting and along the nice kind of...
tractors, hay.
Damp hedges, but nice and warm. Because it's different from the... completely different to West Galway, isn't it?
It's very different.
It's inland.
Yeah. It's inland, yeah. So it's very green and it's very inland. And obviously... you know, I like the space. And I hadn't looked at Athenry before for a novel. You know, How to Build a Boat, I set it in a fictional town mm-hmm. near the sea, as you were. I stuck it in a hospital. So for this novel, I really wanted to write what I knew and the stories of what I knew.
It's like a trilogy for you, these, aren't they?
Yeah.
Institutions, is it?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm obsessed with institutions and buildings and people and putting people into institutions and seeing what happens to them. So the first one was a hospital setting mm-hmm. and it was strangers in a meet in As You Were. And then in How to Build a Boat, it's a boy in a Catholic school, quite an oppressive school. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in him in that space. But in Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way, I really wanted to interrogate the idea of the kitchen yeah, and the idea of yes. the kitchen space in a house as the most political. So I think I worked up to weirdly the most political space, except that we never think of it like that.
No, it's totally unexpected
yeah.
here, but it is the place. And you're fascinated by those farmhouses where you open the yeah. front door, you were straight into the kitchen.
Correct.
And then we had the bungalow. I presume, is that, would yeah. you grow up in a bungalow?
Yeah, yeah, 1970s bungalow. And I am upset. So obviously the old house is there, and this is very present in the story. So yeah. the old houses are dotted across the West.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by how many of them have never been knocked. Or, you
That's
know, moved.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I went on a mad trip to Clare with my husband recently. We were walking in the Burren and I met him stop at any of the abandoned ones. And I won't lie now, I did do a little bit of snooping inside. They were abandoned. It was okay. It was a lovely hot day. I'd have said, I'm lost. I'm looking for the loo. And
because they're kind of sheds now,
aren't
they?
Yeah, they are sheds.
Nobody tore them down.
No. No, and the Hessian sacks in some of them and 10, 20 bags and others. And
wonders inside.
Yeah, and bungalows beside them. So you had these houses and exactly what you said. They had the open kitchen. They had the loft where children slept. And then they built these bungalows in the early 70s. You know, Fintan O'Toole wrote about this in The Bungalow Nation in one of his books.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand that, but I'm fascinated by how we made the room smaller.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like we went into individualism before we knew what capitalism was.
You're dead right.
You know, so yeah.
We were mad for the front room.
Correct.
The good room,
the
hallway.
Good room.
And then the kitchen's out the back all of a sudden. It's a total reversal.
So the first thing I did when I bought the bungalow, well, it wasn't the first thing, when I saved a bit, I knocked the walls and made the big kitchen space.
You were ahead of your time. You said you were in your 20s when you got your family home.
Yeah.
And you bought it.
I did. That's very important.
Very important. You mentioned that.
I think I have the mortgage till I'm 97.
No privilege here, I can tell you.
No, I didn't really understand the generational wealth thing. I think we're all learning about that now. Yeah.
Maybe that's West Galway. No, they'll be on to us as well. No, definitely not. Mayo.
No comment.
No comment, exactly. And that's the character in this story, Claire. She goes back to her home place as well, but obviously more complicated things have happened to her than have happened to you. Yeah. Tell us what goes on from the get-go.
Yeah, so Claire O'Connor is living her life in London and her mother dies in the West in some sort of weird, unusual circumstances. It comes as a bolt from the blue. Mm-hmm. And very, this happens very quickly, so I'm giving nothing away. This is the setup. And she returns for the funeral. And then she goes back to London, and she's living in London with Tom, her boyfriend, her partner of a decade. And she goes back to London to Tom, and she sets her life on fire. She doesn't realise it's grief and anger, and she hears her father is ill. She returns to the West to mind him and look after him. And then she's left alone in the bungalow. And she has, you know, she has, like I said, set her life on fire. So she's left Tom, who is a very unknowable individual, you know, London Tom.
A writer.
A writer.
And he's Where did you find the inspiration for this?
I don't know. And he's writing about extreme sports and ultra sports and men who take part in ultra sports. So that kind of fascinates me, you know. Tom's looking for energy in all the stories and there's, yeah. Anyway, she returns back and she's faced with this bungalow on her own. She has two brothers and the past unravels through just the objects, just her in the bungalow in that space, finding things from her parents. And she starts to have conversations with them that she never had in her life, if that makes sense. She didn't really face it.
Yeah.
And she's confused. You know, Claire is quite confused, a confused character. And I suppose in some ways she's representative of the upward mobility and the progressiveness and the moves, the leaps that Ireland have taken with regards to women and agency and autonomy. She has money. Mm-hmm. She's a lecturer. She has a job. And so she's in the house. And where does she walk herself? You have all this freedom. And where she walks herself? Onto the internet. Into a deep dive on the
great sequences where you sum up the rubbish that we're all watching. But she becomes fixated on the tradwives phenomenon on TikTok. Explain that to the uninitiated.
Well, the tradwives, well, I don't know, do I need to explain it? But I was getting, you know, these algorithms. So I was interested in, you know, I was looking at Claire and I was saying, what would a woman do locked in this bungalow? Because it was lockdown when she was in it. Mm. And I said, of course, she'd scroll the internet. And you're absolutely right. And I said in the last novel, the Vanta black hole of the internet that we all go into. And it's just fascinating. I will get to the tradwives, sorry. But it's just fascinating. No, but you're just scrolling and you're scrolling at such extreme violence and such horrific scenes. And then you come to this woman making a lemon tart in a pink apron, you know, and I don't know, it just fascinated me. And what fascinated, so the tradwife movement is particularly an American thing, but they believe in the conservative values of traditional womanhood, which I do not espouse. But
shock horror. But it's kind of 50s, isn't it? That
it's
50s
very
image of America.
The 50s, and the picket fence idea.
Your man will look after you. You just look after him and everything will be grand.
Do you remember that domestic science book? Were you familiar with it? Where put a ribbon in your hair when your husband is coming in and have the dinner on the table?
I went to an all-boys school, so they didn't give us
that. One for 20 years.
They didn't give us that. Up in the Louis Convent, maybe they did.
Well, the boys, when I was teaching them in the boys' school, I remember saying, you know, it's just such a shock how women's history isn't included on the history course and there's such a small minority. And they said, bless, maybe they teach it across in the girls' school.
Oh my God, the same thing I've said.
History of or for women? What an outrageous assault on the manosphere. That's author Elaine Feeney talking to Oliver Callan this morning about education and her latest novel, Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way, which is published by Harville Secker. And that's all I have for you on this Mentally on the Beach edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether sunnier, sandier, seaier look back at an entire week in radio. But from me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.